This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
This show is for college recruiting fans.
What a run! He's got a lane!
The inside story on the Ducks, the Beavers, the national recruiting scene, and high school prospects across Oregon and Southwest Washington. Recruiting with Andrew Nemec. Brought to you each Thursday at 7 p.m. by Power Rents. Recruiting with Andrew Nemec on 1080.
Hoo-wee.
The Fan.
Hello and welcome. Recruiting with Andrew Nemec on 1080 The Fan. I don't think I can start talking about recruiting. I just don't feel like that's the place I'm at. This has been unquestionably one of the most difficult weeks of my adult life. I'm tired of the way that African-American people are treated in this country. And I'm tired, and I don't feel like I have any real right to be, because I'm fairly new to this fight. My wife and I, my wife is an African-American woman, and we've been together for 10 years. We have a 15-year-old stepson, and we have a 2-year-old daughter. They are both half black. I can't imagine what it's like to be an African-American person in this country, but I can relate to seeing these things firsthand, to seeing racism firsthand, to seeing systematic oppression firsthand. And I want to share that with you guys, because I think it matters. I think it's important. And I think my experience, I was never racist. I was always taught, and I always grew up, that everyone was equal. It didn't matter what religion, it didn't matter their sexual orientation, it didn't matter their race, everyone is equal. And I still have learned so much in 10 years. And in terms of race, I thought as open as I could possibly be. I'm not an African American person, obviously, so I cannot talk about that experience, but I can talk to you about what my experience has been like. I have been told interracial couples make me sick when I was out to dinner. I had a waiter, and this all happened in Clackamas, Oregon. I had a waiter who was waiting on Chantel and I one time ask, are you guys, right in front of her, are you guys serious, or are you just trying to get your black belt? Dehumanizing, obviously, to her, reducing her to a sexual object, fetishizing being with an African-American woman. I was refused service at Stanford's. We went out for a drink. We tried to order some food for a happy hour, and they told us they were out of everything. It took us about 40 minutes to get a menu. It took us about 15 more minutes to get water. I tried to order an appetizer. They told me they were out of it. Literally the table next to me ordered and received the food that I'd ordered, and they told me they were out of. So we left. At my son's school, some white kids within the last few years called his friend the N-word. He went up and told we called them duties. I know that's not what you're supposed to call them, the like recess chaperone counselors.
We called them duties too.
Okay. He told a duty right before lunch was over that these kids had called his friend the N-word. And she was shocked and didn't know what to do and clearly wasn't trained to know what to do. And she was like, just get along. You guys need to get along. Go play. They released the students early who were done with their meal and no adult was out there. Those kids jumped the kid and broke his arm. The school, when they called us in, the principal got the names of the students wrong and assumed what each kid's name was based on the color of their skin. So she assumed our son, Jaden, was a different kid because he's lighter. So she thought he was a name that was more traditionally Hispanic. And she said, oh, you're not so-and-so? And we're like, no, we're not the parents of that kid. Our son is Jaden. And she said, oh, he came into my office and I just thought, you just thought what? And all of that is hard. Each time one of those things happen, it happens in a day and it ruins your day. It ruins your evening, but you're also a little bit ruined for the week. It lasts a long time. It lasts more than one time. When I go to Clackamas with Chantel, we're often glared at. And you can say often, come on, man, really often? Yes, often. Because let's just do the basic math. Let's be way over generous on this number. If 2%, only 2% of the country's racist, openly, the aggressive, I hate black people kind of racist, then that means when you go to the store and there are 100 people in the store, there are two of them who are hate-filled towards my wife and my relationship. Glared at. And when someone glares at you with hate, and it's just you and your partner, you're kind of okay with it, especially when you're younger. I mean, it hurts and it bothers you, but it's like, eh, screw them, right? Screw them, who cares? And when you're able-bodied, you feel like I could defend myself. I don't feel like that anymore when people glare at me because now I bring my 2-year-old to the store and I don't want there to be an incident in front of her. So instead of I can handle myself, Chantel can handle herself, if somebody ever did anything, we're fine. If that glare means something more than that glare, that uncomfortable stare that you don't belong, if that ever turns into anything else, I can handle myself. I don't want to have to handle myself in front of my 2-year-old. I don't want her to see that. Every single adult male in my wife's life, every single one, 100% of the black men in her family have been thrown to the ground and put on the ground by a police officer. Every single one. None of mine have been put on the ground. And it's scary when you're driving home or you find out that your brother-in-law or your great uncle-in-law was driving home in the rain, not doing anything wrong, is pulled over, ripped out of his car, put on the ground, soaked, dehumanized, embarrassed. Then you check ID and find out, oh, never mind, we had a person matching your description that did blah, blah, blah. That doesn't stick with you for just that day. Okay, nothing, air quotes, nothing happened. It makes you feel less than. It makes you feel like you're not a part of the society that you belong to. And then it creates, in the whole family, it creates a sense that they don't belong. They're not treated equal, and it hurts for a long time. And every time one of those things happens to another family member, it builds up more and more and more distrust. So you have generations of families who have not one family member, but multiple family members, maybe not hurt by the police, but embarrassed, shamed, brutalized by the police. Every single one of her family. So it exists. It's real. And I wish more people understood how real it is, because once you're in it and you see it, it's brutal. It's hard to say, okay, great, there are protests and they're loud and they're big and maybe this time they're meaningful. God, I hope this time they're meaningful. But maybe this time, again, they're not. because maybe it's just coronavirus time and people aren't working and they're angry about Trump, or they're angry about not working, or they're angry about whatever they're angry about. And they've decided to get into this fad. And I'm not saying it is. I'm saying in that perspective. And they post the black square, meaning they're all in. And then really they're not, because 3 months from now they forget about it. Maybe that's what this is. I hope not. I really hope not. But it's not just about racism, and it's not just about the experience of a system in the that is the police force that is over the top violent to African-American people. It's also privilege. And I hear so often when I talk about white privilege with my family, with my friends, that it doesn't exist, or it's not something I wanted, or I didn't inherit a lot of wealth. I'm not privileged. I wasn't privileged. I earned everything I got. My grandpa, my father came from nothing and built. Don't you dare call me privileged. I never thought that, but I do hear that sentiment, and I want to explain why it's wrong, and I've seen it firsthand. And the easiest way I know, the most non-threatening way I know to describe it, is kind of silly. But it's so relatable because it's something as a white person I never once thought about. And then once I was in a relationship, an interracial relationship, I thought about it a lot. Chantel she's beautiful. Chantel wants makeup. A lot of women want makeup. There's not a lot of options at most stores. There are a lot of options for white women. There aren't a lot of options for black women. There's dark chocolate, milk chocolate, cappuccino, mocha, and caramel. It's either a coffee drink or it's some sort of candy treat, which in and of itself, you know, wherever you stand on that, that's not the point. But to get the makeup she needs, to get the shades that she is, we have to go to specialty stores. When she wants hair care products, they have all sorts of shampoos and conditioners for white women. You could get a lot, unless you want a specialty product. You could get an array of shampoos, an array of conditioners that treat your hair. Black women don't have that option. They have to go to specialty beauty stores. And because specifically in Portland, we're a very, very white city, and that's just a reality percentage-wise, there aren't a lot of black-owned beauty stores. So they're not easy to get to always, and they're not super easy to find. So she has to make that trek sometimes to get her makeup and get her hair care products. That's privilege. The store caters to white needs. It doesn't always cater to black needs. And it's not your fault. It's not my fault. It's not white people's fault we have that privilege. That's just the reality. And so many people fight against white privilege like it's an accusation. It's not. It's understanding that this society that we live in is built in a way that caters to white people. This Thanksgiving, it was my job for the first time ever to make a Thanksgiving dinner. And I wanted it to be special for my family, but I also wanted it to be special for Chantel's family. So I said, give me some recipes that your family has, and I'll try to make them. Or, you know, and so her mom was going to come and help me make them because I'm not the best cook, but I really wanted to try. So I went to Safeway and got everything I could have needed for a white traditional Thanksgiving. Greens and ham hocks is a very traditional food in a lot of African American families, or Thanksgiving, Christmas, or otherwise. They don't sell that at the store. It's not always easy to get. You can't get ham hocks at the store. You can sometimes get greens, but not always. And we couldn't that time. You better believe that if greens and ham hocks was a big priority for every white family on Thanksgiving, the way cranberry sauce or stuffing was, that Safeway and Fred Meyer and Albertsons and all those places would sell it. Because they'd make money off it. Because they want to serve their customers. You have to go to a specialty store to get greens and to get ham hocks in Portland. They don't sell it at our local Safeway. They don't sell it at our local Fred Meyer. And again, that seems like such a small thing, and you're like, this is about so much more. And I'm trying to explain in a non-threatening way, as a non-threatening way as possible, my experience with this is what white privilege is. And these are some easy, non-threatening examples where you can say, oh, okay, I see how that's privileged. I see how stores, I see how our society caters more to a white experience than a black experience. And if just one or two people out of this message the show, text into the show, message me later and say, you know, I didn't really think I was privileged. I didn't really believe in white privilege, but I get what you're saying. I get what you mean. You're right. I don't. When I go to the store, feel free to look. Happily, if you live in Clackamas, Lake Oswego, West Lynn, Oregon City, feel free at Safeway to go look and see what the balance is between white hair care products, black hair care products, white makeup, black makeup. And it's not just makeup. Again, it's a non-threatening, easy way to talk about this. Go look and you'll see. There's been stores, there's been times where I went and Chantel's like, just get me like a foundation and here's basically what color I need. And I can't. They don't have it. And they have dozens of white colors. That's what white privilege is. I've had so many discussions and so many talks, and I'm so tired. I'm so tired, and I'm new to the fight. And as much as everyone's really excited this time, my best friend is a gay black man. My wife is a black woman. They're tired because they've seen this energy before. My mother-in-law is tired because she's seen this energy before and she's been through it for 40 years. There's a video online of an older African-American man and an African-American man in his 30s. The older man says, we need to protest more violently, more aggressively. They don't listen to us. And the 30-year-old is saying, we have to do it this way because if we turn violent or if we're aggressive with it, they'll stop listening. And he said, you don't understand. They don't listen when we're quiet anyway. It's not working. And a lot of people say, isn't that wonderful? They're having a discussion. It makes me sad. We've had generations upon generations of African-American people in this society who have felt this way, who have grandmas and great uncles and great aunts and beyond that and all through their family and cousins, where almost every male they know has been thrown to the ground by police when they didn't deserve it, just like my wife's family. And then we wonder why people are angry. I see people posting like, hey, support black-owned restaurants. And maybe everybody could get a black, you know, a restaurant from a black-owned business once a month. That's wonderful. That's a wonderful thing. Support African-American businesses, support African-American culture. That's wonderful. It's 2020, and there are people who are just now thinking of that. And that breaks my heart. My best friend has a group. They meet once a month. It's an African-American group. They all meet as black people from Portland, and they share their experiences. And sometimes those are very positive, and it's uplifting. And sometimes it's very, very negative. And it's about not their negative. Their experiences are negative. And they need it as a way to get through things. And I'm tired of hearing my wife and my best friend and my family just get by. I'm scared that my stepson's going to get thrown to the ground and he's going to mouth off because we've raised him to have opinions. And even though we've talked to him over and over about how to handle the police, that he might say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. I'm terrified that something's going to happen to my daughter who's 2. I have zero regrets about being with an African-American person. Chantel is wonderful. She's strong. She's beautiful. She's brilliant. But I do hurt for her. I do hurt for my family. And I'm tired. And I hope this time things really stick. And things with the police department across America, everywhere, really change. And I hope white people who have always said, I'm against the N-word, I don't like racism, I hope they start paying attention to micro-racism, to racism you don't always see every day, to understand their white privilege and to understand and listen to the black experience in America because it's different than mine. It's different than yours. Even if you were never racist, It's really, and never will be, it's important to listen to that experience. Because things have to change. People shouldn't grow up too tired to fight. We'll be back with more Recruiting with Andrew Nemec on 1080 The Fan. How you feeling, Will?
I mean, I hate to be like the opposite, but I'm feeling pretty good.
Good. It's good. It's okay.
Know, you know, that's kind of the crappy thing with all this. I mean, you know, there's a lot of crappy things about all this, but like, you know, I've felt affected in certain ways by this, but in other ways, like, I don't know, lately I've felt pretty good just because I've almost tuned it out. And I guess that's kind of counterintuitive to everything you just said in the last segment, but I don't know, man.
But I mean, everybody's entitled to their feelings. And I think that's what's so important is once we stop listening and saying, you know, honestly, this doesn't affect me. And I think, you know, whether you think the fact that they're protesting, I think is maybe uplifting or however you feel about it, or I've tuned it out because I'm dealing with other stuff. That's okay. I think too often people think they can't say how they feel. And I think because of that, there's this uncomfortable gap between I want to support, but I don't know how to say it, or I want to learn, but I don't know what I don't know. I didn't know about the white privilege surrounding beauty. And it's, again, I'm not trying to make that the end all be all. It's just a really easy, accessible way to talk about it.
Well, that's something I would have never thought about, to be quite honest.
It's something I never thought about. Yeah. And it's important to see it. It's important to see it, to say, okay, I get it. I get where this is coming from. I get what you mean. And I think as white people, too often there's the discussion that I'm not racist. I don't say the N-word. Therefore, dot, 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 dot. And that's not really it. That's not really it. There's a lot. There's a lot to it. And I'm still learning. I am not an authoritative voice on this issue. I am a singular voice. And that's why I thought it was important in the first segment to share just my experience. That is not the authoritative voice of interracial relationships everywhere. That is not an authoritative voice, certainly, of the African-American experience. I can't speak to that. Never will. But I also, and I think this is important too, I see white people on Twitter a lot saying and tweeting, I support you. I'm sorry I never have experienced racism. I'm sorry I haven't. I'm sorry I'm not an African-American person. Don't say that. don't say that. That's condescending. And you don't even mean it condescending, like, oh, I'm sorry. That's not what people mean when they say that. But does anybody honestly think that if, and again, African-American people are hurting by this too, and the way they're treated, to say like, I wish that on white people so you guys could feel it too. They want no one to feel it. Nobody should have to feel that. So to say like, I'm sorry, I haven't felt that too, so I can relate. They would say, and a lot of African-American people, not all African-American, would say, I don't want to feel it either. I don't want you to relate to my experience. I want that experience wiped out from this country. I don't want that to be the experience. I hope we get there. I hope we get there. And I also hope we stay focused on the message. And when things like, you know, Oregon State tight end, Rocco Carley, it was kicked off the team late last night after a video surfaced of racist derogatory remarks towards Muslims, the gay community, African Americans. If we focus on that, if that becomes our kick him off the team, fine, good, gone. But don't check the box of like, I did my good deed. See, I did it, because it's a nonstop fight for equality and for a zero tolerance. And that's step one. And that's the first sign of progress, but it doesn't mean pat myself on the back, I'm done. And I hope we don't get bogged down on just him. Although, because it's newsworthy, we do need to, I think, talk about it a little bit.
Well, what I will say is that this situation puts me in a tough spot, because what he did say was awful and it's completely reprehensible, but here's the awful but, is that he was 17, 18 years old when he said it in high school. That's not to say that what happened was the correct action by head coach Jonathan Smith, but I think that there also needs to be some acceptance from people to understand that this kid has no idea what he's doing in life yet. And he has a long way to learn and a long way to go. It is terrible what he said, but you have to give people the chance to grow and to understand different cultures and to understand different people's point of view. I mean, there is absolutely, and I can tell you as a former Oregon State football player, there's absolutely no place for racism on a football team. None whatsoever. Because it will get sniffed out really quickly and people will turn on you. And not only is it just bad to have a group of people and one of them be racist, but having a team that way too, because they're guys that you count on. They're guys you work with and rely on and get to know really well. And so, again, this is just a tough situation, I think, for him, in that he has the whole rest of his life ahead of him. But as you and I were talking about before the show, his reputation is completely shot.
Yeah, and
in regards to college football.
His hurt does not equate to the hurt of African-American people dealing with what they've dealt with over the years. His betrayal that he feels that a friend posted that doesn't necessarily or come close to matching the betrayal that a lot of people have felt by having people not step up for them when they've been treated terribly or racially profiled. But you bring up a good point. And I think the one concern I have in his defense, and again, there's no defense for his words. What he said is indefensible, wrong. He should be kicked off the team. Being at a school of higher learning is a privilege. He should be kicked out of school. That's how I feel. The one issue I have is it becomes a slippery slope when, and I think of this, when I heard that, one of the things I thought of, first, kick him off the team. One of the things I thought of, do you remember, like, was it Alec Baldwin that got drunk and then said some horrible stuff about his daughter?
Yeah, on Twitter.
Okay. So
Alec Baldwin was one of the first, like, Twitter bombs.
So what I wonder potentially is the slippery slope of, and again, in not in this case, but extrapolating further the precedent. What if someone is blackout drunk, says some awful stuff to anyone, period, but then like goes to rehab, cleans their life up, they figured it out, and then that video or that audio still exists and we play it later and it's like, get them again. And it's like, I mean, there are certain audio tapes that no question that are out there of people saying racist stuff that we've already dealt with and we've already eviscerated publicly, and they've gotten help, and maybe they still feel that. Maybe they've only gotten help for the sake of the PR of getting help. But I do worry about, you know, this lives forever. When he gets a job, when he goes to another football team, are they going to post it again? When does he pay his price? Again, I'm not saying it shouldn't follow him for the rest of his life. Fine. I'm just saying that when you create once someone shares a post of you, no matter what you've done from then on, it hangs with you and you can be punished again. That's where I have some concern. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it goes back to the whole idea that, again, this is a really young kid who made a really terrible mistake. And who knows? Maybe this is really how he is. And maybe he's going to repeat his mistakes over and over and over again, this same type of thing in a different way. We don't know that yet. But publicly, this is the first thing he's done that's caught national attention that is completely disagreeable with anything Oregon State wants in their culture and most people want in their culture. And so it's exactly what you're saying. This slippery slope of saying, is he going to learn something? Are we going to see that he is sorry, that he has kind of widened his perspective? We won't know yet.
Yeah. Neither you nor I are defending in any way what he said. We're not defending that he should still be in school. He shouldn't. It's fine that they kicked him. It's good that they kicked him off the team. It's probably good. I haven't heard that they've kicked him out of school. I imagine that's coming if it hasn't already. And he should be. My only concern is when I see something like this, where it is handled right, my thought is, what does this do for the future? And I wonder if playing years-old audio from people, potentially who have already dealt with that issue, gotten help, progressed, and listen, there are more pressing issues than like, what about this small case? But this was in the news and I think it's relevant. I think there's a possibility that someone did something like this, paid the price, and this is the time now, because everybody knows I'll get a ton of retweets and likes if I share a video of some celebrity saying something that they've already, you know, cleaned up from, gone to counseling for, fixed, they've improved themselves in life and they no longer have those sentiments. And then we kind of publicly destroy them again. And I think that's what's dangerous with multi-year old issues. And by the way, don't say racist stuff, because then nobody can do that to you. Nobody can post anything, any video of you from years ago. But I am concerned about what sort of precedent that sets. I want to talk some recruiting, believe it or not, on Recruiting with Andrew Nemec.
What?
Yes.
No.
The Oregon Ducks are going to get a couple more big-time commitments. I'll tell you who they are next on Recruiting with Andrew Nemec on Tending the Fan. Got to talk a little recruiting. I know, right?
I mean, it's in the show name.
Could be a big month for the Oregon Ducks. They had a big May. They have the number 10 recruiting class in the entire country. But things are about to get quite a bit better. This week, a couple of prospects, Jalen Davies, a four-star corner, and is Xavier Worthy, a four-star wide receiver, both announced they will be committing later this month. I think they're going to get both of them. That's right. I think the Oregon Ducks are going to land four-star cornerback Jalen Davies out of Modern Day High School, and I think they're going to get Xavier Worthy, and those are important because, well, they're four-star prospects and they're really good, but Jalen Davies also has a relationship with Modern Day. That's the high school he goes to. Oregon already has Kyron Ware Hudson in the class. He's an Under Armour All-American selection. Jalen Davies is an Under Armour All-American. If you listen to last week's show, I told you, more All-Americans are coming. Oregon already has five in this recruiting class. They are about to get several more. One of those being Jalen Davies. And this is how building a pipeline matters. And sometimes people think of that as a state issue. You know, like California becomes a pipeline state. Texas becomes a pipeline state. Washington becomes a pipeline state. Even more important than that is becoming a pipeline for the major high schools and 7-on-7 programs around the country. If you build a pipeline where you've built a tradition of landing captains and elite players from, say, Modern Day High School, it makes it the school more easily accessible for you going forward. If you go back to the class of 2019, I have to say it with a question mark, I'm fairly certain that's right, Oregon got four-star linebacker Mace Funa, at the time the highest-rated linebacker in program history. Wah, wah. In comes Justin Flo and Noah Sewell, and he drops to third. But still, at the time, big-time linebacker, still a big-time linebacker, still a big-time get. They landed four-star running back Sean Dollars, and they landed four-star defensive tackle Keon Ware Hudson. Great start, great haul, and you built a pipeline. So even though you didn't necessarily hit on every kid that's come out of Modern Day the last couple of years, you still have that relationship. You landed Keon. Up comes Kyron, who's a four-star wide receiver, an Under Armour All-American, nicknamed Baby Bolden. We've had him on the show. We talked to him about it. Big physical receiver, great hands. Doesn't matter that he can't separate as well as some guys because he's got an unbelievable catch radius, strong hands, and goes and high points the football. That's why he's an All-American. So you get him, you've got that relationship with the brother. He's good friends with Jalen Davies. Jalen Davies is a four-star corner, an Under Armour All-American. Suddenly, you're in the mix for another player. This is where sometimes we see at the end of recruiting classes, you go, why'd they take that guy? Why'd Oregon take that guy? Why'd Oregon State take that guy? Sometimes you take the three-star late in a class that's not quite as good as some of the other kids you can maybe get because you build a relationship. You hope that three-star is a leader, is a well-liked kid within the program, or you've already talked to the coach and you know that, and you hope that it helps you down the road. Sometimes I see a commitment and people are like, why do we care that we got that guy? And it's like, well, one, he's a three-star prospect with offers from half the Pac-12 and he could still be good. I mean, that doesn't mean he's bad because he's a three-star, but also look at the high school he goes to. And look at the classes, not just this year, but next year and the year after. He's buddies with them. He was team captain. He's going to help them with that four-star and that five-star. That's why that matters. And I don't always think people think of that. There's like there's a tremendous kind of underneath layer to recruiting. And once you become familiar with that, once you become aware of that, things start to make a lot more sense. Oregon started this whole run at Modern Day, landing Keon Ware Hudson, the lowest rated guy from Modern Day that they got in all of them. But he had offers from all over the country, and he tore his ACL, and he missed his entire junior year. And Oregon stuck with him. They text him every day. They made him a priority, or DM'd him every day, however that works. They were able to talk to him every single day. And when you talk to him about it, and you talk to his family about it, that meant a ton, because people gave up on him. They stopped recruiting him. So then he commits, and he's friends with guys. And he brings Mace Funa. and he brings Sean Dollars. And he almost lands Jeremiah Crudell, a four-star corner who ended up at Oklahoma. And then a couple years later, his brother comes, and he's an All-American. And his good friend is an All-American corner. Sometimes the piece that you get not only has potential to be a good piece in his own right, but is also a cornerstone piece for something bigger. Pay attention to the politics behind the commitment. Sometimes very, very meaningful. The other commitment I think they get later this month is Xavier Worthy. Why does that matter? Well, as I just mentioned, Kyren Ware-Hudson, phenomenal receiver, Under Armour All-American, Baby Bolden. But if anybody paid attention to Anquan Bolden, who that's a reference to, they know he can't separate. He wasn't a great separator. And Kyren says, I am not the fastest guy. He's not. He's a really physical, box you out kind of receiver. Go up and get it at its highest point, out physical you to the football. But that doesn't stretch the field. That doesn't take the safeties out and force them deep. Xavier Worthy does, because he's one of the fastest players in the state of California. Ran a 10.5500 as a sophomore. Xavier Worthy is that guy. So not only is Xavier Worthy valuable because in and of himself, he's obviously a four-star talent and very, very good, but he also suddenly starts to make the rest of the receiving core make a lot of sense. Not to mention, Xavier Worthy in his own right, forget that he complements Kyren Ware-Hudson, which is wonderful, and you want complementary pieces in your receiving core. You want to diversify things to make things as complicated for a defensive backfield. But he has offers from Alabama, Auburn, Georgia, LSU, Michigan, Penn State, Tennessee, USC, Utah, Washington, Washington State, and multiple others. That's a big-time get. So suddenly we're looking at a receiving core, potentially. Oregon always throughout their history has just struggled recruiting receivers. In their entire history, they've landed four wide receivers who were ranked top 100 prospects nationally in their given year. Four. Only. Ever. In the class of 2015, as I've mentioned multiple times over the course of this show, they had like five or six decommitments. Last recruiting cycle, they got Justin Flo. Everybody was thrilled. Five-star linebacker. But during that early sign period, they also lost Johnny Wilson, who would have been one of the five highest rated wide receivers in program history. 6'6", 230 pounds. Not a tight end, folks. A receiver. 6'6", 230 pounds. He flipped to Arizona State. So as good a job as Cristobal has done, the elephant in the room, is a bad choice because he's a coach from Alabama, I guess, and Alabama hasn't really stifled them too much here.
And he's strong like an elephant.
There you go. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, there you go, I guess.
See, it makes sense.
No,
now.
Perfect. You know what? You totally got me off track. Unbelievable.
Because you thought about Mario Cristobal's big muscles.
Right. As good as Mario Cristobal's done on the recruiting trail, primarily it's been at defense and offensive line and quarterback. They've had a little bit of a hiccup at wide receiver and running back, and traditionally Oregon's always struggled recruiting wide receivers. And this class could turn that corner. Kyren Ware-Hudson's already in the fold, Under Armour All-American. I predict they get Xavier Worthy later this month. Speedster. You've got two four-star receivers. That in and of itself is huge. But Oregon is also probably the odds-on favorite to land Dante Thornton, the number six wide receiver in the country. And they're almost certainly the odds-on favorite. I've predicted they'll get him for Troy Franklin, the number two wide receiver in the country, who's just a few spots below five-star status. Dante Thornton and Troy Franklin would be number two and number three, respectively, in the all-time recruiting rankings in Oregon history at the wide receiver position. So you still have potential when you've got Kyren Ware-Hudson to add Xavier Worthy, Troy Franklin, and Dante Thornton. That is a dream team at receiver. No joke, no exaggeration. You get those four, and you've landed four of the top 10 wide receiver commitments in program history, two of the top three in program history, and you are off and running and suddenly changing things dramatically. Really impressive stuff. Oregon off to it. And by the way, talk about these two commitments and say they might get Troy Franklin, they might get Dante Williams. They're still in the mix for a four-star defensive end over here. They're still in the mix for Kingsley Suamatatia, who I think they get is one of the top offensive tackles in the country. This recruiting class, as I said last week, may not have that five-star headliner, but it might set an Oregon record by a huge margin in terms of number of All-American top 100 recruits. They might sign a class at 22 or 23 and have 19 four-star prospects. And you think, well, that's good. I don't think people realize how good. during one of the Mark Helfrich years, Oregon had something like a total of 12, 13 four-stars on the entire roster. Think about that. They might get more than that in one recruiting class. It's impressive stuff. What Mario Cristobal is doing is next level. And by the way, he's bucking a trend in doing so in a year when all the top, for 2 years in a row now, all the top West Coast guys seemingly have left the conference. They're not staying. So you go, man, all the West Coast guys want to leave. That makes it harder, as we just mentioned. If it's easier to get the guys because you got the group before them, it also becomes harder if they go somewhere else. And for 2 years now, the top players on the West Coast, the top players in the top programs have gone somewhere else. So to be, in spite of that, to be able to put together a top 10 recruiting class, and I think that's what's going to happen. I think I would say it's dang near a slam dunk that Oregon ends up with a top 10 recruiting class at this point, unless they fumble the ball to goal line. I just don't see it happen. I see a top 10 class being almost a slam dunk. That is an incredible effort. I got an amazing question. I loved the question. Somebody bringing up an Oregon State fan talking about the wide receiver position said, why is it easier for Oregon to recruit receivers? And he said, I'm not throwing shade, but just historically, Oregon struggled to recruit receivers and haven't produced a ton of elite NFL receivers. Whereas Oregon State has. Chad Johnson, TJ Houshmandzadeh, Brandon Cooks.
Mike Hass.
Mike Hass won a Biletnikoff, but was a great pro. What's
walk on.
What's the deal there? And I think it's really important because it's really nuanced. And the issue is the difference between tradition and development. Oregon State has tradition at the position. Oregon has a little bit more history as of late developing. I'll explain why that's important next on Recruiting with Andrew Nemec on Tending the Van. I got a great question about the wide receiver position and recruiting between Oregon and Oregon State. And I want to give credit and then address the question. It came from Chad. I won't give out his Twitter handle. I don't want Oregon fan to come after him.
But he said, Chad.
He said, question for you, asking here not to trigger and get in an argument with Oregon fans. So I'm asking via DM. I see you retweeting all of these top receivers considering Oregon, yet Oregon has never produced an elite receiver. Genuinely curious from your experience, is that not something recruits care about? Meanwhile, you look at Oregon State with Ocho Cinco, Houshmandzadeh, Mike Hass, Marcus Wheaton, Brandon Cooks, Isaiah Hodgins, not getting the same interest from these elite guys. And basically, it boils down to this. There is a difference in recruiting between tradition and development. Current coaching staff gets credit for development. What your current staff has produced, whether they've produced it at your school or another school, is development. It's what you personally as a coach coached up and led to. So if you directly coached Isaiah Hodgins, you get credit for Isaiah Hodgins. Oregon State right now has a tradition of great receivers. They don't have a huge long track record with this coaching staff of Isaiah Hodgins, of elite receiver development. They have Isaiah Hodgins. The old guys, the guys that are gone, get credit for Chad Johnson, TJ Houshmandzadeh, Mike Hass, Brandon Cooks. That staff's not there anymore. So they can sell the tradition at wide receiver, but they don't have that depth when it comes to development. Oregon, on the other hand, has a staff that's split from all over, and some of those guys have been the offensive coordinator, have been the wide receiver coach, has been the running back coach, but the primary recruiter for a number of guys who have done big things in college. They get a little more credit for development. Overall, if you're looking at class, there's a reason Alabama, regardless of when they hire a new coach, or Michigan, when they have a turnover at coach, or LSU, or Florida State, that they can still continue to recruit top 15, 20 recruiting classes. Because they have a tradition as a program of winning. But development is where you actually kind of get position by position gains beyond your tradition. If you bring in an elite quarterback guy who used to coach multiple Heisman Trophy winners, you will see an uptick in your recruiting at that position beyond what your tradition is as a program. You're always going to have the baseline of how well you recruit based on tradition, how well you sell your facilities, how good your coaching staff is. But you could elevate that by bringing in a developer. That's the difference. Oregon State right now, when they pitch to recruits, a tradition of wide receivers, there are a lot of guys who, that's impressive, but it only scores, if it's worth 10 points for every pitch, that might score a 5 or 6. That's great. Who did you produce? Isaiah Hodgins. Okay, where are the guys that produce those guys? They're not here anymore. Okay, then you get credit for tradition. Whereas if you go to a program that has a wide receiver coach, and this is just an example, that produced all the recent Clemson wide receivers, all the recent Ohio State wide receivers, Michael Thompson, obviously at Ohio State, DeAndre Hopkins, Sammy Watkins, Martavius Bryant at Clemson, you're going to score a higher score. That's going to sell higher to recruits. Tradition is always a baseline for how well you recruit. Developer is kind of what takes you beyond your tradition of what you normally recruit at the position. Does that make sense? Will Darkins, I hope it does.
Well, what I would say too, at least from my experience with the Riley era, is that a lot of the times they'll sell guys on the fact that, you know, our staff comes from the NFL and we run an NFL pro style offense. And anywhere else, how they're going to use you is obviously in a more athletic fashion, right? They're going to try to space you out, put you into a spread offense so you have the greatest opportunity to get the ball. And of course, that's great. And you want to develop a highlight tape, but really, when it comes down to draft prospects for receiver and what NFL scouts look at are the one-on-one matchups. Yeah, and that's what Riley, that's why Riley was like licking his chops when he got Marcus Wheaton, because Marcus Wheaton is a one-on-one matchup nightmare. Like if you get him alone with no safety giving coverage, like in three or anything, like it's over. You might as well just do an audible and let him run a go. It was the same thing with Sammy Strotter years before that.
But I think what you're talking about there is my scheme develops.
Yes.
You're not talking about tradition at that point. You're pitching development. So that speaks to my point. Development is here are the guys I produce, or if you don't have that where you here are the guys I produce, you can say, here's the scheme. This will develop you, and you will be the first name, the second name, the third name on my list of NFL guys I someday develop. And that's kind of how Mike Riley and his staff did it. They had a pro system. They plugged guys into it that fit, and then suddenly they built that list where they could say, my pro system developed this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy. That's development.
Dude, you don't realize how much at receiver, like, because you know everybody will see somebody who's really, really fast at receiver, somebody like John Ross or whatever, you know. Darius Hayward Bay, the guy who went to Oakland.
Good Lord.
But
Darius Hayward Bay, what a pull.
Hey, man. But what you really see in a receiver who's really, really good is somebody who can win one-on-one matchups. I mean, that is it. If you can do that, at the end of the day, speed, of course, matters. But again, it all comes down to the fact that if you're left alone and you have an incredible opportunity to beat your guy and get a huge score and make a momentum turn. I mean, you're an incredibly valuable player. It doesn't matter how fast you are.
And that's what I think Oregon's doing. I think Xavier Worthy can take the top off of defense, which forces a safety to kind of cheat deep, to respect a deep route. And then everyone else underneath, Troy Franklin, Dante Thornton, and Kyron Ware-Hudson, who's a physical underneath receiver, are all suddenly in one-on-one matchups because that safety has to account for Xavier Worthy's speed. That's why that matters. Thank you for listening to Recruiting with Andrew Nemec on 1080 The Fan. We went a lot of places. I know we started the show with a very, I hope, came across, because it certainly was a very heartfelt message about my experience. Hang in there. Stay tough. And again, thank you very much for listening to Recruiting with Andrew Nemec on 1080 The Fan. Appreciate you.
Thanks for joining us for Recruiting with Andrew Nemec, the show for college recruiting fans with the inside story on the Ducks, the Beavers, the national recruiting scene, and high school prospects across Oregon and Southwest Washington. Read Andrew's latest recruiting news in the Oregonian and Oregon Live, and listen for Andrew's updates throughout the week here on Portland's sports leader, 1080 The Fan.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
It's better over here.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.